Americans are being buried under an avalanche of misinformation and disinformation, enabling the abuse of power. The free press is crumbling. Editors are disappearing. Social media is giving up on fact-checking. Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy.
We are rapidly reaching the point of no return for the planet.
How'd you end up in here?
Oh, well, I tried to start a revolution, but didn't print enough pamphlets, so hardly anyone turned up, except for my mum and her boyfriend, who I hate. But I'm actually organizing another revolution. I don't know if you'd be interested in something like that. Do you reckon you'd be interested?
The Climate Revolution.
Welcome to the 9th edition of our podcast series, The Climate Revolution. At a time when the world more than ever needs leadership on climate, what happens?
We will drill, baby, drill.
The most powerful nation in the world decides to download and launch Trump 2.0.
How bad is it?
That's the problem, sir. We don't know.
Severe thunderstorms have smashed Sydney and parts of New South Wales, leaving one man dead and thousands of homes and businesses without power.
I've never seen anything happen like that before in my life.
A red warning is in place for the entire country. Here, it's being called the storm of the century.
Southern California is experiencing what experts call extreme drought. San Diego recording its driest start to winter in recorded history.
Who pays the price for climate destruction around the world? Not the fossil fuel industry, pocketing profits and taxpayer subsidies as their products wreak havoc. Every people suffer, with their lives and livelihoods, with higher insurance premiums, volatile energy bills, and higher food prices.
We need a revolution. Revolutionary thinking, revolutionary action.
Everything's changing, Robert.
Your child was always going to change.
The world is pivoting in some new direction. It's reforming. This is your moment.
You seek the Holy Grail.
That is our quest. Our quest is to find the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Yes,
it is.
And so we're looking for it.
Yes, we are.
We have been for some time.
Ages.
So, enter the reboot of the entire human operating system. How do we reboot the human operating system, you may ask? Well, Sue Barrett has been putting some thoughts into just that. Sue Barrett is an Australian business strategist and educator who's engaged in politics and democracy as well, a community-independent advocate and organizer based in Goldstein, Melbourne. She says, similar to what we heard the former American President Joe Biden telling the world, yes, humanity's operating system has been infected, but it's not beyond saving. And this is where the climate revolution gets really interesting.
Research in sociology, psychology, and evolutionary biology actually shows that humans are hardwired to work together, share resources, and build systems based on trust and mutual benefit. It's actually how we've survived and thrived for millennia. But the current system has been corrupted. And this sort of fair collaborative operating system that's, you know, held us together pretty much through all sorts of, you know, traumas and challenges and events is now riddled with viruses. And I've put that in terms of neoliberalism, the corporatization of pretty much every aspect of our life, the erosion of democratic institutions, the rise of authoritarianism, and in particular, the excessive power of tech billionaires who have hijacked the system. I'm referring to this actually, and it's not just me, but many others, as the second gilded age. A tiny group of elites are hoarding wealth and power while the rest of us actually are struggling, particularly with growing inequality, climate breakdown, and of course, they're weaponizing social trust by weakening it. And they're distracting us and, you know, Musk, you know, for example, Elon Musk, has coined the term the woke mind virus, and he's weaponizing that to make sure that we feel fearful, that it deflects attention away from their exploitation of resources and power, and basically trying to undermine this operating system of fairness and accountability that actually has protected us. So the systems, you know, I mean, systems are complex, and that's the problem, because a lot of people out there throw simplistic answers to complex situations and issues, and they're always wrong, because a system is very, very complex, particularly human operating system. But the most dangerous thing about that human operating system that really brings it down is corruption. And we're seeing that on a massive scale. So like a computer that's infected with malware, society often continues to run, albeit sluggishly, while the damage actually spreads underneath. And we've kind of, the last 40 years, we've kind of reached peak kind of infection.
Mr. Reed, can we get out of here?
I don't know if your listeners are aware, but of course, unlike supermarkets, pharmacies, and any other businesses in Australia, electoral material, like political advertising, actually doesn't have to be truthful. Basically, they can avoid the traditional advertising rules the rest of us have to abide by and actually get away with just spreading lies and disinformation. And what they do then is by having these sort of clickbait headlines and things that are set to enrage people, to actually ignite kind of really gut reactions, fear-based reactions. This is how people who want to divide us, divide us. This is how they create misunderstandings. People get scared of the other. They don't want us coming together and working and operating together collectively. Sure, there's plenty of differences in the world, but the things that we share in common are far greater than the differences any human has with any other human. But they don't want you to know that.
I know their system very well. I managed to break through. All we need now is the perfect message.
So we're going to shoot a series of propaganda clips. Spreads the word. And we're going to stoke the fire in this rebellion.
They want you to be scared. They want you to be frightened. They want you to doubt others, etc.
More and more, I find monsters wherever I go.
I read this really interesting story about this history teacher who is teaching their students about the Salem witch trials. And they said, right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to whisper to in your ear, each of you, whether you're a witch or just a regular person. And so I went around and whispered into every student's ear whether they're a witch or not. And then the game was whoever had a witch in their group would lose. Okay? And so this teacher set the activity up and off the students went. And of course, eventually what started to happen is these little cliques would form and groups would happen and bigger groups, and then they'd split because they're all looking at each other, not believing each other and being very wary of each other. Anyway, they stopped the experiment, and then the teacher asked the students, hands up in the room, who was classified as a witch? And no one was classified as a witch. And this just shows you, as a very simple but profound example, what this kind of social media, this, you know, advertising, these clickbaits, this propaganda, these lies, this disinformation does to the human being. What it does to us is it makes us fearful. And then we look at everyone else as if they're the witch, and they're not. And so I just think that, you know, our operating system has been, the human operating system, as I said, it's been infected by incredible, powerful people. And we've seen signs of this in the past when the human operating system has been hacked, right? The rise of fascism in the 1930s. Basically, fascist leaders like Adolf Hitler exploited social instability. They spread lies and division and they gained power. But I want you to know this because my husband, who's German, took us to the Documentation Center in Nuremberg, which is on the Nazi rallying grounds. And this museum documents the rise and the Second World War and the fall of the Third Reich. And I was there on the 1st of January 2017. That's when I was there last. And what particularly, you know, had me just stand back and go, oh my God, we're here again, was reading all about and listening to the complicit nature of mainstream media, not just the German mainstream media, but media worldwide, big business, and certain public service institutions like the railways, who got behind Hitler and the Third Reich. And when you watch all of that and you see what they did to propagandize the population, this is history repeating itself. And people don't seem to understand that.
With these actions, we will begin the complete restoration of America and the revolution of common sense.
It's just that now with social media and the internet, it's on massive scale. And the problem that we had was that a lot of decent people back then and now didn't know about the system, didn't understand what levers were being pulled, and got sucked in to this propaganda machine and then made decisions about how they voted and what they did that ultimately ended up backfiring badly. I don't know if you're aware, Mick, but after Trump got elected the second time, apparently the most searched terms on the internet in the US just after the 5th of November election was, what is a tariff and how can I change my vote? And this is the thing, when you don't read beyond the headline and you don't dive into the details and you don't sit back and understand what's happening, because that's the other thing. All of this clickbait stuff that's being thrown at us is designed for us to react immediately and go and become outraged and do this and do that and look at the other with, cautious eyes and wariness. What we have to learn to do is be more discerning, and that is to, whenever we see something, rather than react in a gut way, is to stop, take a deep breath and think, I wonder why this is here. What are they trying to do with this? What's actually happening? Is this real? Is this a lie? Is this useful? Is this harmful? These are the sorts of things we have to do. But if you're not working like that as a human and you're under pressure, under stress or whatever, or just don't know how to handle yourself and navigate your way through this complex, complex world that we live in, I can understand why people react from a gut perspective. But one of the things we could do in Australia, at least from a political standpoint, is actually bring laws that demand truth in political advertising. And that's where our community independence, particularly, I know Zoe Daniel, who you know I'm associated with, is very much advocating for truth in political advertising. Because as I said, every other business, an institution in this country has to abide by that, except the political parties and politicians. It's crazy.
Well, I've never seen somebody so incapable of making a decision.
I mean, I've always had this saying in my business and in life, watch who you let near your mind. Because the other thing, the way the brain is wired, it's wired for risk, risky stuff. It's wired for, you know, metaphorically, the grizzly bears. So if a grizzly bear appeared, you know, you've got to react and, you know, save your life. But this is where these bad actors are preying on this. They're putting up information, and it's not actually information, it's disinformation, which is lies and propaganda, to prey on our, gut response, rather than actually educate the populace to help them understand and how to make informed and good decisions for their own best interest. Like I said, these oligarchs, authoritarians, demagogues, the coal industry, fossil fuel industry, you name it, they don't want their money-making operating system disrupted. So they would rather throw us all, you know, to climate disaster just for profit, money, and power.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
At the heart of this conflict is a battle between truth and science and power and lies.
And so I'm sorry, but I'm not putting up with this. And I think if we can learn as humans how to be more discerning and what is effective, we can actually make better decisions and not fall prey to the bad, you know, acts and actors that actually don't care about us at all.
You have to ask yourself, Professor, when faced with the unknown, do you step away from the void or do you dive in?
Sue, I would like to introduce you to Aaron Regenberg. The first time I heard about him was in the podcast Planet Critical, run by Rachel Donald up in the UK. She did an interview with this lawyer, American lawyer, who's working for Public Citizen. And speaking of the fossil fuel industry, here's someone who's trying to actually do something when it comes to the lies and the way that we are being, you know, manipulated by the fossil fuel industry.
It's not the case that, like, there is no alternative world we could be living in where my son wasn't looking down the barrel of an unlivable future right now. The world has come together to solve big problems. Like, humanity can do that. We did it with ozone. We've done it with other things. And we didn't do it here because there were specific decisions and specific reckless or dishonest conduct by specific corporate actors and individuals. And, you know, I'm with this organization, Public Citizen, that has been working to develop the sort of legal theory and case for criminally prosecuting big oil companies for the harms from climate-related disasters. The reason that we're doing that is because I don't think you can say that these are just tragedies. You know, as people across our country are losing their homes, losing their livelihoods, losing loved ones, you know, losing mothers or fathers or daughters or sons, it's tragic, but it's not just a tragedy. These are the effects of specific decisions, specific reckless conduct by a relatively small number of actors, of corporations and individuals leading them, who knew what they were doing and predicted exactly those consequences and went ahead and did it anyway and made ungodly amounts of wealth doing it and continue to do it, continue to double down, continue to make bank off of that misconduct. And so we're in a situation where we need to be talking about accountability and we need to be talking about justice. And from our perspective, we need to be talking about criminal justice, because a lot of that conduct in relation to the harms that it's created, we think constitute criminal offenses. I think it is becoming clearer and clearer. Like, it was not that long ago that climate change was mostly talked about as this, like, problem for the future, right? It's a problem for our kids. And again, I think we are seeing more and more that is not as much the framework and paradigm, because we're seeing the real material consequences every day. We're seeing the fires. We're seeing the floods. We're seeing the extreme heat that's killing hundreds and hundreds of people. And so I think it is becoming hard to deny that climate change is a public safety threat, right? It's arguably the greatest public safety threat we've ever seen. And so I think it's becoming an easier case to make that there should be a public safety response, right? The reason ostensibly that we have criminal law is to protect us from dangerous actors that would do us harm. And so we don't think it's crazy to say, what if we use this system that has disproportionately been used to target poor folks and communities of color? But what if we used it instead to protect our communities from the powerful corporate actors that are endangering us more than anyone else at this point? And the fact that we have on the books right now multiple criminal laws that we think do a really great job of describing and proscribing precisely the conduct of big oil companies, again, not to downplay the challenges, but we think we need to be talking about this and exploring it. And I think that there's a real chance that we're going to see criminal climate prosecutions and that it could, you know, it could play a real role in protecting communities as the criminal law is supposed to do.
So, Sue Barrett, the reason I wanted you to hear this and our listeners to hear this is, to me, this is a great example that there are good people in this world who are working on the kind of stuff that you're talking about, Sue. The movement is there, and it just makes so much sense what Aaron Regenberg here is talking about. What do you think?
Oh, as I was listening to that, Mick, I just kept nodding and nodding and nodding and nodding. And back earlier this month, on the 5th of January, I wrote an article called When Leaders Act Like Dogs and A Time Without Shame. And everything he's saying is in fact what this article was also referring to. So there's an old saying, and it goes back in ancient wisdom and all sorts of traditions, called there will come a time when there is no shame and leaders will act like dogs. And what it basically means is that it captures the deep malaise many societies experience when power is divorced from ethics and leaders act not as stewards of their people but as opportunists and sycophants who are driven by personal gain rather than the public good. I mean, that's what he's just described, right? And in contemporary times, our times, this warning is prescient. Because how else, you know, can we describe a world where billionaires, oligarchs, and criminal figures like, you know, convicted criminal figures like Donald Trump can ascend to positions of immense influence and power? How does it actually explain political parties morphing into influencer marketing machines, serving donors and special interests instead of their constituents? And what of the mainstream media, who are complicit in sensationalising this conflict, normalising corruption, and often failing to hold power to account? This is where we're kind of at, which is why we need to reboot the human operating system. And we know the corrupting force of money in politics. We know how this actually affects us, but also too, as I said, party politics is sort of kind of the rise of the influencer machine. It's more of a branding exercise than actually delivering clear policies. And so it's a problem that, you know, the behaviours of politicians have sort of been coming more like reality TV stars than legislators. So this is why, you know, me and many thousands of other people have put their efforts into changing, at least in Australia, the two major party system. We're looking at that community independence model to, you know, to bring back accountable politicians into the fray. And the good news is, just so you know, talking about things to do, is that at this at the 2025 federal election, there are now 30 community-backed independent candidates running in seats across the country. Like, and this includes the incumbents like Zoe and Monique Ryan and Zali Steggall and the like. But there are now 30 running across the country. That is a fifth of the House of Representatives. That's huge. So community independence isn't a moment, it's a movement. And it's an antidote to exactly what Aaron, myself, you and I were talking about now. But I would like to bring something up as well, if we come back to universal values, because wokeness is really just a modern term for universal values that we, you know, most humans hold true and want to actually see embodied in their environments and their communities.
Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy.
I want to bring back the role of shame as a moral break, because shame, when properly understood, is actually a critical moral break that helps prevent harmful actions and actually fosters accountability. We're not talking about shaming people for being different or for their personal circumstances. That's toxic shame. But we're talking about societal expectation that leaders and individuals act with integrity and in the public interest. Healthy shame, which is what I'm focused on, operates as an internal guide, reminding people of their responsibilities and the consequences of their actions. So in many ways, the erosion of shame among leaders has paved the way for shameless pursuit of power, wealth, and self-interest. So when figures like Musk and Trump act without regard for the norms and ethical boundaries that actually hold society together, they set a precedence for others to do the same. And without the moral restraint that shame actually provides, leaders are emboldened to manipulate, exploit, and deceive with impunity. So I think we should be reintroducing the concept of shame, grounded in accountability and respect for others, because it's vital to restoring trust and integrity in public life. And so I think this is where we want to really look at this sort of challenge and this opportunity, because shamelessness is what we're witnessing. Okay. Mm. I'm not about toxic shame. That's not right. It's very distressing and very damaging to people. That's not what that is. But shamelessness, this is what we're seeing. A world of shamelessness where these people just think they can do anything and the media have let them loose. So the role of mainstream media, who should be, if you look at the principles of journalism, the watchdog of democracy, have in many ways also become complicit in this unraveling. So, for example, sensationalism sells and complex truths don't even generate clicks. So this is why people aren't reading beyond these sensationalist headlines. They just make a decision based on some clickbait. And the media's, particularly mainstream media's, focus on personalities over policies, conflict over consensus, and scandal over substance has actually created an environment where these demagogues are thriving. So by platforming these lies and giving undue attention to these bad actors, the media actually then normalizes this behavior. And for every investigative report that exposes the corruption, there are countless hours of free airtime given to every, you know, the very figures that are undermining democracy. The result, a public that is increasingly disillusioned, confused, and disengaged. And this is where you have this, you know, this moral bankruptcy creates then the problems. Now, people might find this interesting too, because this is not just, you know, me having a bit of a, you know, a whinge about this or whatever. There is a lot of really smart, capable, amazing people, past and present, who are doing incredible work and have done incredible work to help us understand our complex human operating system. One of them is psychologist Albert Bandura, whose work on moral disengagement, please, everyone, search up moral disengagement, provides critical insights into this crisis that we're facing. So moral disengagement actually refers to the psychological process by which individuals then rationalize unethical behavior, making it acceptable in their own minds. So they justify it to themselves. Yeah, that's fine. Leaders, corporations and mainstream media particularly as well often use the mechanism of moral disengagement to justify harmful actions. So that's from dehumanizing marginalized groups to framing destructive policies as a necessary evil. The process allows them to actually act without guilt or shame, and this then perpetuates further corruption and injustice. So if people can understand this phenomenon, it's key to addressing the root cause of current moral and political decline. So that's just something I think the term study, go and study moral disengagement. That's really important. The other one that I want to, a couple of other things. There's another amazing, Albert Bandura only died actually a couple of years ago. Karl Popper died last century, but Karl Popper is a philosopher who warned us, amongst other things, about what we call the paradox of tolerance. And basically what this means is if a society tolerates the intolerant, it will destroy tolerance itself, okay? So it allows extremists to spread lies and dismantle democratic norms. And basically what happens is these people rely on us kind of giving up and surrendering, and then we end up in barbarism, basically. Politicians who accuse others of wokeness, for example, reveal more about their true intentions and own fears of accountability and change than the people they're actually criticizing. Such attacks are desperate attempts to actually shield themselves from the scrutiny of a fairer, more just society. So to me, you know, the antivirus system, you know, like wokeness, are actually designed to protect us from these sorts of threats. Defending wokeness isn't about being overly sensitive. It's about preserving the fairness, collaboration, and justice that, you know, makes societies function. So we've got moral disengagement. We've got Karl Popper's The Paradox of Tolerance. And the other thing I want to introduce people to, and just to let them know that, interestingly enough, the historian Rutger Bergman, who's alive and well, wrote an amazing book called Humankind, A Hopeful History. And what this book does, and his work, and the work I do in my professional life and community work, reminds us that humans are wired for kindness and cooperation. That's our fundamental operating system. Look, there are the extremes, but the majority of people are wired for this. So far from being that selfish or cruel individual that, you know, certain economists and people like to promote, the majority of people are decent and actually want to help others. This is actually our greatest strength and the ultimate defense against the virus of another concept I'm coming to called pathocracy. But kindness alone isn't enough. Like any operating system, humanity needs maintenance and updates to actually stay healthy. So we need to make sure that we can ensure that we are energized and capable to confront injustices and hold power to account and stay vigilant to emerging threats. So let me just talk a little bit about pathocracy. Kind of this one sort of summarizes it, sort of where we're at, particularly with the rise of all the demagogues and, you know, authoritarians. There's a concept called pathocracy. And pathocracy was actually developed by a psychologist called, and let me pronounce his name correctly, Andrzej Wobczewski. He's Polish, and he actually fought, he was part of the Polish resistance in World War II. And he describes pathocracy as a system of governance hijacked by individuals with pathological traits such as narcissism, psychopathy, sadism, Machiavellianism, and, of course, a distinct lack of empathy. His experiences resisting the brutal Nazi regime actually gave him first-hand insight into how authoritarian leaders manipulate societies, exploiting fear, division, and disinformation to seize and maintain power. He observed that these so-called pathocrats thrive in environments of chaos and mistrust, systemically dismantling institutions of fairness and justice while consolidating control for their own gain. Does this sound familiar? Yeah. But it gets even more interesting. Like a virus infecting a healthy system, they disable society's natural defences. That's its trust, collaboration and accountability, and redirect its resources to serve their destructive agendas. All right? His work offers a chilling warning. Societies can be corrupted from within when power falls into the hands of individuals driven by greed and cruelty rather than empathy and decency. Importantly, these pathocrats are a vocal minority. So here's this. Studies show that individuals who seek to dismantle justice, equality, and sustainability represent no more than 10 to 15% of the world's population. So they're the minority. However, they rely on our apathy. They rely on our silence and our inaction, that of the majority, to maintain their grip on power. So by creating division and fostering mistrust, they actually then weaken the collective resolve that we need to challenge their control. So, as I said, the Second Gilded Age is a prime example of pathocracy in action, with the tech billionaires dominating public discourse, corporations rewriting laws in their favour, and democratic institutions being eroded by lobbying and disinformation campaigns. These forces actually exploit humanity's operating system, draining resources and destabilising society for profit only. So that's why I've been writing all of these articles. It's not that I am anywhere near as clever as the people that I'm quoting and putting forward to you, but I'm trying to join the dots of our operating system. And there's other dots I haven't even touched on today, but I thought this might be useful for people to think about what can you do, because no one's coming to save the majority, right? No one's coming to save us. We have to save ourselves. And whilst we're not the sort of, most of the people aren't the sort of people that would stand up and rally and, you know, be, you know, go out there and, you know, stand at, you know, whatever it is. We have to. And we have to find ways that we are going to hold these people to account. One of the ways, not the only way, but one of the ways is who we vote for. And that we actually are really clear about what we are buying into. Because we don't want, after Australia's, 2025 federal election, to have people Googling, how can I change my vote if, people who get into power don't serve our interests, who are more akin to what I've just described as that pathocracy. So there's a couple of things that we can look at because it's a big system. It can seem overwhelming, but I always live my life by these three questions. What can I control? What can I influence? And what's outside of my control? And I always focus on the first two and then take action, but keeping in mind of these bigger systemic kind of things. So one of the things I do is write and speak and set up community campaigns and lead and educate and, try to be the best role model I can be for these sorts of things. So I don't sit back just musing and writing. I put all of this as best I can into business and societal action and help mobilize people so that they don't feel helpless, because the antidote to helplessness is hope. And if we look at this as really important information that we can then factor in and protect ourselves from the disinformation stream, and then take better actions and work together and see beyond division, it's very hard to hold back against the forces. There's a great picture. It says, don't panic, organize. And the picture is the top level. There's two sets of the picture. Don't panic. It's like this big shark or big fish coming after all these little fish, right? Don't panic. And then the second picture is the school of fish massing together, chasing the big fish. And that's the organized bit. I hope that makes sense for people in explaining it. So don't panic, organize everyone, get yourselves together and see what happens. Anyway, we can talk in more depth about some of the practicalities, but I thought I just want to set those things up. So as a reminder, moral disengagement, study that. The paradox of tolerance, study that. Study the fact that humans are by nature kind and cooperative. And the fourth thing is understand pathocracy and its impact on our world, and then get organized and get active.
I do feel, talking about rebooting humanity, we need a little bit of a manual, don't we? We need to have some sort of, here's step one, this is step two, here comes step three, and so on. What are your thoughts about how we approach this in the best way? Where do we start? For instance, when you talk about getting organized, yes, that sounds all good and true, but how is it done?
Well, that's exactly right. So you can't organize around nothing. There's an old saying, if you don't know where you're going, every road will lead you nowhere. Okay. So decide what bit you can control and influence. All right. Because there's many aspects to the operating system. So let's think about government, for example. So we've got local government, state government, federal government. All right. They're the institutions that are meant to be representing the people. Okay. So you have to be able to first scrutinize, and you could use the information of moral disengagement. So if you use the filters of moral disengagement, you can assess actually the effectiveness or not in terms of, how corrupt or ineffective they are. You can actually assess how morally engaged or disengaged politicians are and the parties are. So number one, make sure you know what good looks like and what it doesn't look like, and assess. Then make your voice heard with these people. Demand better. They rely on us being too busy and too distracted and, not able to do, do something. Write letters to them. Talk to them. Make sure that they know that you're onto them if they're not actually standing up for the values that you want. Now, whether they listen to you or not is another thing, but that's a test as well, a test of character. So that's one thing. The second thing is that you can do in that space is if you don't like what you're seeing and they're not representing your, the broader community's values and actions and principles and policies you want, start a Voices of group in your local area. You could do that at local government level, state level, federal level. Start to understand that. You also need to probably update our, understanding of, the software on civics and how politics and government actually work. The level of education in Australia on civics and democracy is very, very poor. The biggest group of people that are being targeted by these, bad actors are the disengaged voters, and they're very vulnerable to being tricked with this, lack of truth in political advertising. So educate yourself on civics. Then, as I said, if you want to do something because the politicians that are meant to be representing you aren't, start a Voices of group at whatever level that you need to. And listen to those people, run kitchen table conversations, talk to people about what's important to them, help everyone understand what we have in common, and then look at the things that we share together, regardless of our religion, our ethnicity, our, cult, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. What is it that we care about, and how do we want government to better represent us and have our voices heard? So start, there's a lot of great information on the Community Independence Project. If people type that in to their Google search bar, you'll find it. And there's lots of great advice there about how to start Voices of groups and get something going. And that's why it's amazing, because the first community independent that got elected was Cathy McGowan back in 2013 up in the regional Victorian seat of Indi. And they had just had enough with their local member who hadn't listened at all and was very party politically oriented. And so they started getting together, and lo and behold, it wasn't by much, but they actually shifted a seat that had been in the Liberal Party's hands forever, basically. And then Cathy went on and got greater margin the next round in 2016. So there's one seat that was turned through community activation. And the changes that have happened there have been fantastic. They've got the things that they needed for their local community, plus also working with the national, agency in mind. In 2019, Cathy retired and Indi put forward Helen Haynes, who got elected and with even a greater majority in Indi. But at the same time, Zali Steggall was found, stood against Tony Abbott in the Sydney seat of Warringah, and she ousted Prime Minister Tony Abbott. Okay? And so what you've got there is you've got actually two seats in 2019. Then in 2022, another six seats came along, so it made eight. You can start to see what's happening. This election cycle, a lot of people have been paying attention to this because they're frustrated, like many of us, that their voices aren't being heard and they're witnessing the degradation of our democratic institutions. So at the next federal election, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, there are going to be at least 30 community-backed independent candidates running at the next federal election in 2025. That's a fifth of the House of Representatives seats, okay? It's across the country. This is not just in certain large states. This is everywhere. So have a look at that. There are more voices of groups than there are community independent standing, because there are other communities that aren't ready to have a candidate yet, but they're getting ready for the then next election, 2028, whenever that is. So this is how you can start a movement. This is how you can get things happening. You can learn from all sorts of amazing people now part of this. You know, there are now tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people now around Australia who are making a stand.
Reason is humanity's special gift. It allows us to understand the structure of the nucleus. It enables us to explore the heavens. It helps us to conquer disease. Now we must use our reason to find a way in which we could live with nature and not dominate nature.
So don't worry, you're not alone. There's lots of great support. There's that. Sorry to take so long on that, but it is a huge lever shifter. It really shifts, the dial, whatever metaphor I'm using. And then as part of that, what you're doing is reinstalling integrity back into a system that's being corrupted. And this is why supporting community independence and other leaders who prioritize accountability, fairness, and sustainability as part of their work for, you know, their communities and constituents is a huge lever shifter. What we also want to do is eliminate disinformation. So if you encounter lies or injustice, don't just accept it. Speak up about it. That's what I do. I look at evidence. I look at stuff. And this is why I write, you know, the things that I write, because I'm looking at, I don't want people just to go, oh, this is how it is. No, it's not. You don't have to stay like this. So we need to challenge the propaganda, even in our own circles. Now, one of the ways to challenge it is not to say, Mick, you're wrong, because that's not going to get you anywhere. One of the best ways to challenge it is ask questions. That's really interesting, Mick. Tell me more about that. What are your thoughts on this? And where did you get this information from? I'd like to understand more. Hear what they have to say. Because what often comes out is they don't know how to talk about it. And it might just be, you know, a bit of a clickbait kind of thing. And they've just been reacting to it. And if you can, unpack it further. And just start having conversations and be more curious and interested rather than judgmental. So try to be neutral, even though I know sometimes inside you want to, just, you know, kind of go, you just slap them on the face about something. Right? Like, how could you believe that? Try to just to take a breath and listen. I have found when I listen to people and I ask them to explain what they mean by something, tell me a bit more about that. I'm curious, how did you come to that conclusion? Oftentimes that opens up space for then you to share some concepts and ideas. And they go, oh, I hadn't thought about that. You go, yeah, I know, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, and just don't tell them to change their mind, because that's a hiding to nothing. Just ask questions and see what happens. And then if you have interesting fact-based, evidence-based information that is written in a way that they can relate to, just share stuff with them and invite their feedback on it.
This is so important. You don't change people's minds by telling them what to do or coming with a lifted finger and all that. No, active listening. There is that concept of active listening. You know, psychologists use that as a way to get people to change their mind.
Yeah, I'd like to build on active listening to also reflective listening. Reflective listening is when you reflect back what they've said to you. So that is actually a very interesting concept, that if you say, so Mick, what I hear you saying is this, and reflect it back to them. Sometimes for some people, in fact, not just sometimes, quite a lot, is they go, oh, no, I didn't mean that. No, and you go, okay, what did you mean? And then it gives them this chance to verbalize, and because a lot of them haven't actually thought about the concept in a coherent way or even the consequences of this. But you just start asking. So I found that is one of the things. And this is the thing. These air game that these bad actors are playing by filling our inboxes and, you know, feeds and thingies with just crap, one of the best antidotes to that is a human-to-human conversation. So we need to reconnect. You know, with this whole social media connection, we're lonelier than ever. So actually the antidote for this is to get out and go for a walk with someone, have a conversation. So the next thing would be, and that's how you can actually eliminate disinformation. The next one would be then to strengthen your networks. So join forces with community groups, active networks, organisations that are standing up for and fighting for justice, climate action and equality. Join those groups, have conversations with them, and start working on how you can get your voices heard and people can see what you're doing is more visible. I think we need to upgrade the ethical systems that we operate by. So I think we could shift our focus to spending our money with businesses that actually prioritize sustainability and human rights. I'm not talking the greenwashing, human washing businesses, but the ones who genuinely are looking at supply chains and eliminating modern slavery and that kind. Now, that takes a bit of work. But running human-centered businesses, which is what I've been working with and advocating for over 30 years with my business, is very profitable. When you have businesses that operate, you know, work well together, collaborate, prioritize collaboration, not just, you know, sort of, you know, competition. And so they actually work and provide really great human-centered experiences for their clients and then staff and suppliers. They are much more robust and successful. So that whole ethos and practicality about running good businesses. So whether you're a customer, a worker, a supplier, whatever it is, think about the businesses that you work with and how you operate together as a unit and as a system. And then also too, I think we need to demand environmental security. So it comes back to Aaron's comments. We need to use the law, the laws that exist, to hold corporations and governments accountable for their role in the climate crisis. We need to advocate for policies that prioritise our planet over profit. So we need to use the law where we can to, whether it's class actions or whatever it might be, to, you know, and I'm not a lawyer. I'm a science graduate by background in medical science subjects and things like that. But there's sometimes I'm lying awake at night, I'm thinking, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if we could just take them to court and they would actually be, you know, held accountable and forced to change and all that kind of stuff. And we can do that. It's that we need a political system that will back that up and support it. And we need people to actually demand attention. I don't know if people can remember, but back in on the 15th of March 2021, I was part of the organising leadership group that helped create March for Justice, where we were standing up. We wanted to end gendered violence and stand up for women's rights and equality. And that was an idea 14 days earlier. It went from an idea to 110,000 people turning up to 200 locations at Monday lunchtime around Australia to protest against that. That was incredible. I made sure the messaging was very human-centered and inclusive, and I wanted it to speak to people who were so frustrated but they didn't know how to act. And so your messaging is very important. It can't be divisive. It has to be invitational, inclusive, focused, and intentional. And honestly, that event has actually kick-started and changed a whole host of systems in Australia. So do not underestimate the power of people to come together, but you have to have a clear purpose, good messaging, and it needs to be something that is easy for people to start to participate in. And then, like what we're doing here, share the update. Stay informed, spread the knowledge, help others see through the disinformation. The fact that you've invited me here today to talk about, you know, upgrading, you know, the human operating system is exactly this example. And podcasts are very popular. So we want to make sure that we have really good content we can share with people. And I think that this really allows us the opportunity to strengthen our defences, restore fairness, and protect us from the forces of division and greed. Does that help?
Absolutely. It is about restoring trust, I think. That's a very big one. And in particular, restoring trust in that human beings are fundamentally good beings.
Yes.
That we aren't born evil.
No.
We aren't born to be trying to cheat each other. And there are so many of us that we can, if we spoke up, we can actually change the name of the game.
Exactly. So, I mean, look, there is that small percentage of people who are wired differently from the majority of the human population, okay? But no one is born racist. No one is born sexist, right? No one is born with misogyny. No one's born that way. We're taught those things. And if you can learn them, you can unlearn them. And this is what's really important, that, you know, by being able to look at and this term wokeness, as I mentioned earlier, it's just a modern term for universal values that we all share, regardless of whichever tradition in religion or culture we come from. When we look at these universal values, we look at them, wokeness and the golden rule, for example, you can see it written across all sorts of books of wisdom, all sorts of religions. It's interesting, isn't it, that we have all these different religions, but at the core fundamental of this is, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That is essentially across, written in however, you know, whatever way, but in each of these areas. So it's Islam, it's Christianity, it's Judaism, it's Buddhism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And even if you're not religious, it's in, you know, human-centered values. So the humanist society, the same sort of things there. And there's also the value of justice across cultures as well. Social justice is also seen as an important value across all kinds of cultures because that's how we operate well. And empathy and compassion, why do we encourage people with, you know, to be empathetic and compassionate? Because they're universal pillars of humanity. And sustainability is about a shared responsibility about how we live together. So we have to challenge the division that's being created at the moment by a few who just want money over and power over everything else. And we need to challenge this division through our shared values and build a bridge to a better future. And when we come together and we have human-to-human conversations and we listen to each other and we find out what's important and how we're feeling and we tap into our natural capabilities of curiosity, helpfulness and fairness, and guess what? There is very little difference at all, and we can really help each other move forward. And I will see out the rest of my life fighting for this.
All revolutions seem impossible until they are inevitable.
With Trump coming in and talk of drill, baby, drill, of course there's going to be more support for fossil fuel producers in the United States. So they're already producing at record levels. So that's not going to move all that much in the near term. More importantly is that the scale of transition energy investment and the prices coming down is already sufficiently great around the world that it's unstoppable politically. The global energy transition is continuing and actually speeding up.
We can make love our revolution. In the moment of history that we find ourselves in, pessimism is a luxury we simply cannot afford. And the pessimism that justifiably emerges from our analysis, our lived experiences, and our observations can, must, and should be responded to by the optimism of our thought, creativity, courage, actions, and our sense of humanity. We can make love our revolution. We can make love our revolution.
Hi, I'm John Foley, and I'm the Executive Director of Project Drawdown. For 2025, I'm thinking about rebooting climate leadership around the world. Why? Well, I just don't think we can afford to leave the fate of the world to the UN and elected politicians anymore. It's just not working, as special interests are running the table. It's like that old definition of insanity, doing something wrong again and again, expecting a different result. Maybe we need a more expansive vision of climate leadership now, one that embraces leaders from grassroots communities, cities and states and provinces, but also from business, philanthropy and investing, people who can basically move capital and move people far better than elected politicians have done so far, and also to shift the future of technology, behavior, culture and science to a better place. In other words, we need a bigger view of the climate chessboard, looking at all the players and all the moves we can make. And if we rethink our approach to climate leadership in 2025, I think it could be the year we start to accelerate meaningful action again, catch up for some of the lost time we have, and start building the future we want and the world future generations deserve.
The relentless pursuit of a better world. The great men don't give up that pursuit. They don't know how. And that is what makes them invincible.
This revolution is about everyone. It's about all of us. And we need a voice.
There just could be a change in moral attitude from people worldwide, politicians worldwide, to see that self-interest is for the past. Common interest is for the future.
If you want to be part of the climate revolution, find your role. Contribute with what you think you're good at. My name is Mick Eit, and you can reach me on the email address mickeit@climatesafety.info.
All revolutions seem impossible until they are inevitable.